You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Onyx Maps. Now, Onyx is one of those must-have pieces of hunting gear. Now, it's not a physical piece of hunting gear. It is an app that you download to your phone, and it allows you to view topographic maps, digital imagery, and it allows you to leave waypoints and basically breadcrumbs and collect data of all the properties that you hunt. So real quick, this is how I used Onyx this year, specifically on my South Dakota hunt. So we knew where we needed to glass. So we had camp. That was a waypoint. And in the dark, we had to basically walk 1.3 miles in the dark in terrain that I had never been in. And when you can have a map up on your phone and basically put together a strategy of the path of least resistance to that glassing point, I was able to navigate better in the dark. Then once we got to our glassing point, the sun came up and we started seeing deer movement. I was able to then put together another plan of how to get from the glassing point to the location where we started seeing deer. And the entire time I was documenting that hike. Hey, there's some water here in case I need it. Hey, here's where I saw a mule deer. Here's where I might want to glass the next day, and just basically documenting everything and allowing yourself to have the most information at your fingertips. And it's just one of those things that I think is has no value because it's so important. And Onyx does that. And the best part about all of it is you don't need 4G to use the app, right? You can save an app or save a map to the app, and then you can use your phone's GPS to navigate that map. And again, just a really awesome piece of equipment that I would recommend to any hunter, whether you hunt 40 acres of private or on 33,000 acres of public, there is a function for every hunter. So if you want to find out more information, visit onyxmaps.com or visit the App Store and download today. And when you purchase, enter the discount code NATION20, NATION20. And all first-time users will save 20%.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
I'm here. How you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good, good.
Living the dream.
Living the dream up in Michigan. Is it, how snowy, how wintry is it today?
It's not too bad. It's snow, some snow on the ground, not very much. Unusual for this time of the year up here.
Right. We actually had a little bit of snow on the ground earlier this week. Now it's all gone, of course, but did not feel like southern Missouri. We don't hardly get any snow, but I know that's a much different story from you guys up in your area, which kind of brings us into the discussion of managing deer and habitat in Michigan. That's kind of like the, if we give this podcast a topic or a theme, that's what we want to do, because you have some great insight to be able to share with listeners over the course of several years and managing a property and having a lot of success on it. So I'll let you kind of take it from here and may discuss how we met, how we kind of got started, work with each other, and then we'll just hit it off.
Okay. Well, we bought this property a couple years ago and really didn't do much the first few years. Wanted to kind of just get a lay of the land and get a feel for things rather than just firing up the chainsaw and getting after it before really trying to think things through. And listening to your guys' podcast over the year, wanted to get someone with more, who is more knowledgeable than I am. And, you know, thought along the same lines and really liked what you guys had to offer and your input on a lot of things, and have since brought you guys up here and trying to implement a lot of what we discussed and went over. And, yeah, there's a lot to do and a lot to working on.
There's always a lot to do. So given your location, let's say western central Michigan, that general region, you know, when you bought the farm, did your farm look really any different from the surrounding landscape? That, you know, was there like a defining feature or anything habitat wise that you're like, oh man, that's just the place that I need or I'm looking for? You know, is there anything that separates it when you bought it from the surrounding area?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I really like is I am the, for the most part, the cover surrounded by ag.
Mm-hmm.
This is the hub where the deer go. And they live here for the most part. But the other thing that I really like about it is I really don't have a lot of road frontage.
Right.
My parcels has a little bit of road frontage, but for the most part, it's tucked back in the woods. And I don't have to deal with people shining, or sure, which is legal up here, or mm-hmm. being nosy other than my immediate neighbors. Sure. So it's not, people just can't drive by and see what I'm doing up here.
So, I mean, everyone knows, and we'll kind of give you a chance to review some of the season dates and everything and hunter numbers up in Michigan. But Michigan's a state where humongous hunter numbers. I think it's second to, I know it's in the top three, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the top three states for licensed deer hunters. And, you know, pressure is one of those things that you have to deal with. And set up a property appropriately to be able to handle that pressure when you have goals of harvesting older age class deer, which that was kind of what you came to us with is, hey, I'd like to see exactly what we can do with this property because I'd like to harvest 4.5-year-old deer and older. So what do we need to start with? But so kind of break down the seasons real quick for Michigan and the things that you may be dealing with in an area that is definitely high pressure from hunters.
First thing I will say is I am not from Michigan originally. So when I moved here, I was...
Disclaimer. Kind of,
yeah. My mind is kind of blown with the amount of pressure that is truly put on these deer up here. I mean, we have really high deer numbers, but the hunting culture up here is different than what I was used to back home in Nebraska. Certainly. It's just people up here don't really shoot does. Mm-hmm. There's a 2-buck limit. The seasons are extremely long. They start with first there's a youth season and that's in September. And then October 1st starts with bow. Then it goes into November 15th, opening day of gun season. That runs for 2 weeks. Back into bow season. And then muzzleloader season opens, which in our unit, since we are now in a CWD observation zone,
right,
during muzzleloader, you can use rifles or straight walled cartridge rifles. So that season runs for another few weeks, and then it goes right into antlerless gun season. So when it's all said and done, there's a 45-day gun season going on.
Wow.
Where the DNR is almost encouraging everything to get killed, and a lot of people up here really like to shoot their bucks. So
yeah.
The number of hunters around here is mind-blowing.
It's definitely a deer camp atmosphere, which is a cool thing to be a part of, I'm sure. But it does present other challenges when you have certain goals of shooting older age class deer.
Yeah, and like we have a co-op up here, and that's really nice because a lot of guys are think along the same lines. But the problem is, so many of us are so spread out that we're all are on our own little island. So
because of the parcel sizes typically in Michigan, what would you say most guys are hunting when it comes to property size in your co-op there?
In my co-op, it's probably either a 40 or an 80.
Okay. Yep. So no just large contiguous blocks of land that really, you know, one owner or one small couple groups of guys are hunting. you know, you've got 40s and 80s with several hunters on them potentially, you know, stacked on top of each other.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Then they're right on the line, and
sure,
everybody's other property is greener and better on the other side, of course.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. So this year you harvested a great buck. I would say you probably accomplished the goal, not that it's just one and done, right? But you harvested a really great deer in Michigan. Kind of break down, let's say, the story of that deer, lead us into the hunt, and then we'll kind of backtrack a little bit and get more into the actual management side of things as to what's been done on the property since we visited with you, and why you were able to have the success that you had in harvesting this deer.
Mm-hmm. So I've this deer that I shot this year, he was a 4.5-year-old. I've had pictures of him and seen him on the farm for the past few years since he was 2. That's when I first noticed him, because he had a unique brow tine. And I don't even really keep track of the 2-year-olds. I only kind of start keeping track of deer when they're a 3.5-year-old up here.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I don't even want to get my hopes up, because I know they're going to get killed.
Yeah.
So last year, this particular deer, he was a 10 point with a couple extra stickers on him, and probably about 140-inch deer. Really, really nice deer for up here. And that was kind of where I set my goals moving out here, was if I could hunt 140-inch deer,
yep,
every few years, I'm hopefully like 3.5 or older, I would be happy with that. I think that was a realistic goal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So last year I hunted this deer, and I had multiple occasions where I had him in at under 20 yards and couldn't get a shot at him.
Wow.
Then I finally was able to put a shot on this deer, but he was in some brush and I didn't get any penetration, and he survived. So I kept getting pictures of him the rest of the year. In the meantime, I went to Iowa hunting and shot a Boone and Crockett out there.
Ooh.
And when I came back to Michigan, I had another chance at this 140-inch deer with a gun. And it was probably beginning of December when, yep, this happened. And I decided, you know what, as much as I see you around here, and I think you're going to make it, because most of the pressure is right during that first few weeks of gun season.
Sure, sure.
So I let him go. I kept getting pictures of him. And then he made it through the season and vanished. And I didn't get any pictures of him at all this past year when he was a 4.5-year-old. I didn't know if he was dead, hit by a car.
Like no through idea. through the summer time frame, spring and summer, no pictures.
Correct.
Yep.
So he finally decided to show up during the weekend of the youth season. And when I was out with my 6-year-old trying to get him his first buck, and
yep,
I don't think I could have mentally kept it together if that deer would have walked out in front of us. but he showed up, and once he showed up, he didn't leave. He was here every single day. I had pictures of him right behind the barn.
Yep.
Just nonstop. And it was all I could think about. And you can ask my wife how stressed out I was over this deer, knowing that what goes on around me, just the number of people. He could just take a wrong turn and get shot. You never know.
Definitely.
So,
and a lot of that activity, though, was at nighttime. Even though he was on your property, it was still kind of cover of darkness, dawn, dusk hours, correct?
Yeah, he didn't come out into daylight. I mean, I have a lot of cameras up around my property, and he didn't start showing himself until towards the end of October,
mm-hmm,
during daylight. But all my cell phone cameras,
yep,
would be right after dark or right before sunup, and he was in the areas where I thought he liked to bed.
Sure.
So he was always around. There's multiple times where I'd see him. I caught him a few weeks before, or a week before I shot him. I saw him on the hoof, and that was exciting.
You sent me a small little video of trail cameras. I believe it was like a sequence of a doe came. You walked into the food plot and then you hunted, you walked out. A doe comes to the camera right after you leave, and then he's like right behind 5 minutes after you left, or you know, something silly like that.
Yeah, and then come to find out he was there that morning, and that was the first time I got a picture of him in daylight, was in this food plot. Mm-hmm. I wasn't hunting the food plot. I was hunting maybe 80 yards into the woods off the food plot, and he was bedded on the other side of me. So we were probably 150 yards from each other that day.
Yep.
So it was close.
Cat and mouse a little bit back and forth, but you were narrowing down kind of the search and were finally able, I guess, what was the straw that broke the camel's back in harvesting him?
We had a weather front coming in.
Okay.
And it was a real high pressure day and tree rut was kicking in. And it was supposed to really start downpouring around 4 o'clock. And I went out at 2 o'clock that afternoon. Got up into a tree stand, and I really liked this spot. It was actually like 50 yards from where I shot him the year prior.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And I'm sitting up in this tree, and I wasn't feeling good about it because I just felt exposed since we did a timber harvest a couple months earlier. All of a sudden, this tree is in the wide open.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm sitting there, and I decided to move my tree stand during the middle of the hunt. And I swung it around the backside of the tree and
bold
get set
move,
up.
Cotton.
What's that?
I said, bold move, Cotton.
Yeah. So I get it turned around. And now I've got a bunch of cover behind me with some beech leaves. And
yep.
I'm sitting there for maybe a half an hour, and it just starts to rain. And I just happen to look over my shoulder, and that deer is walking right at me, and he's 25 yards away.
Oh, yeah.
So if I were facing the other way, I would have saw him coming.
Sure.
I grabbed my bow, turned around, shot him, and then it just started downpouring. And it happened so fast, I didn't know if I made a good shot or a bad shot, so I elected to back out of there.
Sure.
And got a group of guys together for the next morning. And we went out, and we started kind of combing the woods because there was no blood. We had, I think, a couple inches of rain that night.
Jeez. Yeah. Kind of the worst-case scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't good. But we ended up walking north and south, and he ended up running straight west, and we ran into him, and he ran maybe 175 yards.
Oh, gotcha. Perfect.
So he was slightly quartering too.
Yep.
And took out his lungs. It was a better shot than I thought in the moment.
Sure.
And yeah, found him, and my wife was happy because my hunting can now be done, and my obsessing was all done.
Right. How big did this deer kind of tape out more than what you thought? Was he bigger once you got to him and got your hands on him than kind of what you're expecting from cameras?
No, he was actually smaller than I was expecting.
Okay.
He's a 6x6.
Yep.
With a drop tine and a kicker, but he was very narrow.
Gotcha. Right.
He didn't have any width, and he taped out at 163, which for up here is
stellar.
You just don't come across them that often. They're here. There's great genetics up here. But what the gauntlet that they have to make it through is, you know, it's almost impossible.
It's very tough. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. And when you look at, let's say, the potential from a resource standpoint that is available in Michigan, and I shouldn't just say just Michigan, because we talked about it on last week's podcast when we broke down West Virginia and Ohio, but when you look at what's there and what you have, let's say the dough to make the bread, the dough is fantastic bread. I mean, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the recipe is there, but you don't ever get to make the bread or eat the bread because the bread dies at 2.5 or yearling stage. And hey, that is what it is. That's regulations, hunter numbers. Glad that there's a humongous number of hunters there and strong in the heritage and tradition. But if those are your goals, then it does make it difficult. But from a resource standpoint, Michigan looks really, really good on what's growing there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had great success there. Okay. We've seen this deer grow up. You kill them, you harvest them, but it's not just a hunt. You know, you've put a ton of work into this property. And we say, you know, many of the species are good. You've actually had to deal with a lot of bad species or species that you don't want, ones that we're terming invasive species. What has been some of the most painstaking management that you've done on the property in the realm of invasives?
That would be autumn olive.
Yes.
It is everywhere, and it is really tough to kill.
Man, it is. It is. You said that you had a couple different techniques that you've been trying, and kind of paint the picture of just how much and maybe how it started or spread there on the property.
Well, our property is surrounded by neighboring properties. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. People up here used to plant it that with multiflora rows, and it's just everywhere. I'm not going to get rid of it all.
Right.
I'm just going to try my best to contain it.
That's right.
Over the years. And it was also planted on by the previous owners for cover. And it started with right behind our barn. There was probably 3 acres of autumn olive. And right when I first met you guys, it was, I just started using my tractor grapple, and I would go down, grab the root ball and rip it out of the ground.
Yep.
For the most part, that worked. There's a few spots where I can see it's growing back, because sure, that stuff just takes off like wildfire.
It is incredible how fast it grows.
If you cut that stuff, it just explodes.
Yep.
So some of it worked, some of it didn't. I got to go back in and start treating some of that.
Yeah, with a foliar application, right?
Yeah, and what I found for that is you got to spray everything.
You have to.
If you miss a branch, it's going to keep going.
Yep.
We also did a prescribed fire this past year, and if the younger autumn olive, it would kill that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the bigger stuff, even stuff that was literally on fire, is now stump sprouting with autumn olive.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So it's coming back. The young stuff, it'll kill. The more mature stuff, it will not kill it.
Right. At least from the value of that prescribed fire, it resets it, so it takes all that energy and sends it into some new shoots, and it helps to concentrate. If you come back with that foliar application, concentrate the leaves in the surface area to collect herbicide. So instead of spraying, let's say, a bush that's the size of a couch, now you're spraying an area that's much smaller, very concentrated, so that herbicide becomes quite a bit more effective there. And you just use less herbicide. But, man, it is aggressive stuff.
Yeah. And the last thing I did was I go around with a chainsaw, cut it down to the ground,
yep,
and treat it with a herbicide.
Yep.
And that seems to work, but it's just tough on the back to...
Well, and you almost feel like on some of those, because of the way they grow, the shrub, and just like this globe-like structure, you have to cut your way in just to be able to get in there. Then you've got 4 different stumps to cut out of the one. It's tough. It's work. There's no doubt about that.
I hate the stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you probably hate with a passion more than most people because you've been actively doing it. But I'd say definitely good for you. So what has been the response there from natives after the autumn olive's been removed, or let's say managed?
Well, in this one particular area where there was 3 acres, I ended up with a buddy of mine going in and planting some warm season grasses and some mm-hmm. forbs. And it is amazing how the deer right next to a food plot of soybeans and corn surrounded by oats and crimson clover, they're over in those forbs and grasses browsing.
Isn't that funny?
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're so blinded, I think, truthfully, because there's that, let's say that the presence of grasses and forbs that used to dominate the landscape in a lot of Michigan. A lot of people don't know, part of it was just oak savanna and prairie.
Mm-hmm.
But man, that stuff was there, and now you're bringing it back, but able to see just that snapshot of a smaller little area of how beneficial and how wildlife key into something like that when you've got a food plot right next door, or you had an area that was just straight up invasives, that probably at some point was used for cover because cover's relatively limited in your area and it's at the right height, but now you've got cover and food in the same area. That's the big difference.
Yeah. And hunting smartly and staying out, and I try to stay out of my woods.
Sure.
Like completely stay out, leave these deer alone, and it seems to work.
Fantastic. So you mentioned it earlier, but you said there's been some forestry work done on the place, specifically mm-hmm. select cut across the whole farm. You had some trees of certain definitely value when we were there kind of evaluate and saw. So you had a lot of different potentials of ways, let's say, skin the cat of creating sunlight and getting sunlight back to the forest floor. Because when you kind of kicked off the podcast, you know, initially this farm was very attractive to you from the fact that, hey, there's a lot of ag in and around me, but this place has the ability for me to manipulate and put a lot of cover and hold potentially a lot of deer that might be utilizing that crop ground. But now getting in there and seeing, wow, it is, say, a lot of closed canopy, or was a lot of closed canopy. How'd you attack that, and how is this select cut and future harvest, timber harvests, how is that affecting the deer and the way that you're choosing to manage?
Well, putting a lot of the tops on the ground has made a big difference in bedding and mm-hmm. cover and screening for me. I worked with a local forester who knows deer hunting. He knows what we're trying to do here and on our neighboring properties.
Yep.
He's worked with them. So honestly, I wish we would have cut more trees.
Sure.
I want all the trees on the ground now. But
this is like a true statement of less is more. And we talked about it kind of pre-show, pre-podcast, but it was like, you have to, from a tree standpoint, like from a cover standpoint and a tree standpoint, like it's like you have to remove the trees to actually get the cover that actually matters. When you look at the aerial, it's like, oh wow, that area could have some really good cover, kind of be holding deer, but at the right level, it's not even there. It's not even present. So when you're talking about cutting more trees, more tops on the ground and more sunlight, that's what's going to be getting you what you want.
Well, it's funny because there was a timber harvest here. I want to say it was maybe 9-10 years ago.
Yeah.
And actually, it might have been less than that. But you can see some of the areas that were cut, how quickly those canopies closed in.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So the last owner was like, it didn't do what I wanted it to do because it just closed up so fast. So nothing, no sun got to the ground. And then the areas that were more open, you see this little growth area where the sun is hitting and it's really thick, and you're like,
sure,
I want more of that. I want that everywhere.
Yeah, it's like a tease.
Yeah. And yeah, we've got a lot of oaks here on a certain side of the property, and trying to somewhat manage those without going crazy. But the areas with the popple, the soft maples, we're hammering those.
Sure.
And they're never going to amount to anything. And I want this to be a good hunting property for my kids when they get older. And so that's kind of how we're to manage that.
Sure. When you're talking about hammering them, you know, are you going back in and doing any type of follow-up management after the harvest is done? What does that look like for you?
Well, what do you mean by follow-up management? Going in, cutting out the bad stuff, and then try to do some crop tree release and stuff
correct,
like that?
Correct, yeah. Things that may have been missed.
Yeah, anywhere, what I deem, I'm no expert. I'm mm-hmm. just going off of what I'm trying to learn.
Sure.
If I'm seeing some sort of valuable timber, a hard maple or some sort of oak, especially whites, because we don't have a lot of whites here. We have some bur oak, but the actual white oaks, they're few and far between. I'll try to let them go and give them some sunlight.
Sure.
But we also have a lot of white pine, mm-hmm. and we have another crew coming in that's going to do a pulp cut, hopefully in the next year.
Right.
Who knows when that'll take place. So that'll be more areas of the farm that are going to get wiped out and hopefully grow back thick. And
so at this point, how many acres are you going to have of the timbered acres that will have some sort of forestry practice, whether you harvest from a select cut or the pulpwood cut? How many acres are actually going to be touched and affected by that?
Everything.
I like it. I like it. That's aggressive. That's what you got to do.
Yeah, there's some areas that are just garbage soft maple that,
right,
in talking to our forester, we're like, it's never going to be anything, ever.
Right.
It's, you know, multi-shoot trunks. And
sure.
We're like, we're talking, and it's like, okay, let's just clear cut that. Let's just whack it.
Let's just put some sunlight there. Let's just make it something that's valuable. And have you noticed, I know it's been just maybe a year's worth of regeneration in some of these areas, but the stump sprouts that come back, how aggressive are deer foraging on those?
Our deer numbers are so high, everything gets eaten out
it's,
here.
It's hard. You don't have that vertical vegetation coming back because it's just getting pounded. So
before this was done, you could literally walk into the woods and kind of just bend over to about 4 feet and look all the way through the property.
Wow. Now what does that look like when you do that in the areas that have been select cut?
Now there's tops everywhere, and I need to kind of push those around and move them where I want them, because the deer just crawl up in them and bed, and it's almost predictable where they're going
to
bed.
Sure. You could almost walk through and point to something. It would basically be like in our area, or what should be, let's say, in your area, portions of your area, shrubby cover areas where you have plum thickets. Now you have treetops, and the deer are congregated in and around these areas, or sumac groves. It's no different. The cover is still the exact same from one to the other, but you just had to create it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's going to be touched with a timber harvest here in the next little bit. But prior to actually, you know, having any timber work done, under your ownership, there were some areas that were open. I guess that had been clear cut before, and we had a lot of what looked like good quality cover on the property. You talked about it pre-show. Those areas were starting to mature, starting to get very closed off. So what were you noticing from a deer observation, hunting observation, how deer were utilizing them? And then what management practice was recommended and followed up with, and how has that changed the way deer are using those areas?
Well, these areas were really overgrown with briars and were extremely thick. A lot of autumn olive growing in them. And this is an area, one of these areas I burned this past spring.
And how many acres was that burn that you did?
It wasn't too big. It was our first burn on this property. So, you know, kind of little.
Sure. A little testing.
Yeah. And then it was probably 7 acres.
Perfect. Yeah.
And then after that, I just started burning everything.
Now, I guess why
smaller areas?
Yeah.
Smaller areas.
Why did you start just burning everything after that? What was it that it was like, okay, I want to test it, I want to see it? What was the response that was like, this is awesome?
Just the flush of growth, seeing all that young growth getting browsed on. The deer moved back into that area. Deer are now browsing, are bedding in there.
Even prior to you guys burning it and setting it back and hitting that reset button on those areas, deer weren't bedding in it. It was almost too thick or too choked out, do you believe?
Yes. In the past few years, they stopped using it like they had prior.
Mm-hmm.
And like the open areas really responded the best.
Sure.
Where it was full sunlight. Some of the areas with trees that were maybe between, I don't know, 6 and 12 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them survived.
Right.
And underneath there, you can see where it's open compared to where these trees are, how the difference in the understory is night and day.
Certainly.
So I'm going to have to go back in and start cutting some trees down over there. But there's a little false confidence in burning. So there's, sure. I've got a lot of trails on the property.
Yeah.
And some of the smaller ones, maybe an acre in size, I would just start slow when the weather was right. And
sure.
Just get more confident as I keep doing it. And yeah, now it's, I'm confident to start doing it again this year.
Absolutely. And you don't need to be convinced of the benefit at this point on. You saw an area, 6 acres, that was, let's say, mediocre in its habitat and offering. But now you reset it, you changed it. You didn't, and this is an important thing, you didn't plant anything, you didn't necessarily add any species, but the composition probably changed a little bit as you reset everything. More sunlight got in, deer activity skyrocketed, forage skyrocketed, and they're bedded back in there. So easy confirmation of, hey, I need to do this elsewhere. And you're going to be able to do that a lot better and a lot more now that you actually have sunlight getting to the forest floor. Because if you weren't into those areas, tulip poplar and the maples, you wouldn't have been able to run a fire through there throughout much of the season, especially with your growing seasons, the way your climate is and how quickly that gets a closed canopy and holds moisture, retains moisture.
There's a lot of water up here and sure. a lot of areas that hold water. So nothing really ever truly dries out in some of these spots.
Right. But now you might be able to manage and manipulate those areas a little bit more because you've actually opened up the canopy and getting cover on the ground that's going to truly carry a fire, dry out, and allow you to manage it, where some areas would just avoid.
Mm-hmm.
That's super exciting. So all in all, knowing the goals of the farm, they haven't changed, but seeing the development of the property over a couple years, what are some of the big takeaways for you as you're continuing to learn the property itself, but then also learn kind of the way it responds to management? What are some of those big takeaways for you?
The wildlife really appreciate it.
Yes, that's beautifully put.
It's amazing how I can look across on the neighboring properties and talk to my neighbors who constantly text and ask me if I'm seeing deer.
Yeah.
And I go out and see 20 to 30 deer in a sit, which is way too many.
Sure.
But the deer know where they're safe. The deer know where all the good stuff is. They pile in here. And that's really my goal. And it's fun for the kids. And
oh, totally.
Learning all this is, it's like an obsession now. It's kind of funny. My wife just makes fun of me for it.
What about, and this is always one of those kind of like aha moments, I guess. And you have a unique perspective coming from Nebraska originally and moving to Michigan. Probably hadn't hardly ever seen or hunted around so many trees in your life. Or let's say had to appreciate the power of sunlight reaching the ground. But now as you have managed and started to open it back up, what do you say to those people who are apprehensive or nervous about going forward with a timber harvest who have goals of increasing their property value for wildlife?
You don't need trees to kill deer or to even hold deer.
Yeah, I like it.
I mean, preach. You really don't. I had a lot of my neighbors here who were asking me, well, tell me, that used to be so beautiful over there. Well, it might be appealing to the eye for us, sure. but it serves no purpose for anything else.
Right.
And I'm not managing for timber.
Right.
I've got a few spots on the farm that, you know, do have that park-like setting, and those are mostly oaks, and those might be managed just slightly differently.
Sure.
But otherwise, I have no problem also hunting off the ground, like tucking into a thicket with a bow.
Yep.
That's fun for me, and I enjoy doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And if I can hold more deer and grow bigger deer, I'm all about that.
Definitely. So, you know, as you look at the property in the next 5 years, what are some of the other management techniques? We haven't even talked about food plots, honestly, at all in this podcast. You had those prior to us being there. And you've done some work in and around food plots, edge feathering. But as you move forward in the next 5 years, what are the kind of stuff that you're going to be keying in on management wise?
Really trying to control the autumn olive, the multifloral rose, and I do have some switchgrass on the property that's mm-hmm. a monoculture and it's just way too thick. I want to dial that back.
Right.
And get more, if I have to plant some forbs and native grasses, I will. Sure.
Or dormant season disking as a potential to increase yep. forbs back in there.
But, I mean, everything needs to take place in a process. And
that's right.
First thing was, you know, talking to you guys, getting a plan together. Then the next step was getting the timber crew in here. And now, or the select cutting crew. Now I need to get the pulp crew in here so I can do even more stuff. And, yeah, there's this. I don't even know where I was going with that.
there's just so much to do, but you do have a plan on moving forward. And basically it sounds like to me, it's just opening up the canopy and letting nature run its course in the area. What are some of the species, I guess, that have come back? When you say, okay, I cut this area and this little place that gets sunlight shines, what's coming back in there? Because it's so hard for a lot of people to imagine, let's say those listening in Michigan or, you know, a similar area, Wisconsin, New York, Pennsylvania. What are some of those species that, boom, pop back automatically?
Sassafras.
Sassafras, like, gets there.
It goes off like wildfire.
Right.
Oaks are slow.
Sure.
For me, you'll find them tucked away in little spots that come back. Otherwise it's grasses and briars and some different stuff. I'm not real familiar with all the names of everything, but
sure.
The maples seem to go pretty quick, and the beech.
Yep. Yep. When you did the first burn, what time of the year was that and how quickly did it begin to green up?
We burned in May, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe a week or two, and everything just started exploding.
Right. The right amount of soil temperature. Right. You had full sun to these areas, or mostly full sun, and it took off like a rocket. How quickly, because, you know, when you look at the south versus the north in your region, you're burning May. Down south, it's like now in February, and then they start to green up in early March. You're still in snow at early March time frame, so the growing season is so much shorter. But how quickly did it take for that vegetation to get back to a foot, 2 foot tall?
Probably midsummer, it was right back to, it was like head height.
Yeah. And that's a short growing season, and you already got back that fast.
Yeah, and that's a lot of, that was the area that was choked full of briars and other stuff, but it wasn't as thick as it was before.
Sure.
Other areas that I burned with a lot more sandy soil.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that thick. It didn't respond like that, but it's also not as open as that other area.
Sure.
Was.
Fantastic. What do you say to the guy who's in your shoes and in Michigan? What kind of encouragement can you give him who has a similar mindset of, I want to shoot good quality deer? What do you say to him, and what's your best advice?
Well, being part of the co-op up here is mm-hmm. fun, and getting talking to different guys with the same mindset as you, getting new ideas and kind of encouraging you, and also showing that it can happen around here.
Certainly.
But for guys in Michigan, for habitat wise, just, you got to start somewhere, try it and learn as much as you can. Try not to overhunt your property. Be sneaky, hunt certain winds, certain ways. Don't hunt the same stand all the time. I mean, there's a lot, all those common stuff that everybody knows.
Sure. They know, yet they don't practice. But if you've practiced it and put it into place, and it's been rewarding. You've had it pay off for yourself. So there's a lot of merit to that.
I realize not everybody's as obsessive about, okay, well, I hunted that stand, I can't hunt it again, or I can only hunt that stand once or twice a year, and just jumping around and catching deer off guard. And I mean, I'm almost anal over it. I won't even let my wife walk out by the barn during hunting season. I get upset about that. But if I go walking through the property, if I take a wrong direction and blow the deer out of here, they're gone for days.
Yeah.
I mean, just because they don't feel safe. Yeah.
Sure.
So it's just, that's why I want to continue to make it as thick as I can and keep hunting it smart and see what happens.
Absolutely. So you have a really well-developed road system, like you said, there on the property. And so do you find yourself hunting out to in, you know, hunting the fringes, observing, then getting in there and kind of striking and getting right back out? How have you approached that?
Yeah, there's a few areas that have like a pie-shaped road system that I'm going to be changing because it drives me nuts. It's just wasted land at that point. Nothing's going to bed there. You're just a worthless spot. I want to move some of my trails to the border where I can. But yeah, I hunt the outside, like you said, and then figure out where they're moving, go in when the time's right, and then get out of there. I'll go in one way and I'll walk out another way.
Perfect.
I'll always keep the wind at your advantage moving around your property.
Definitely. And that's super key on smaller size property and parcels. It's that the 40, the 80. If you're not hunting and treating that thing like the whole thing like a sanctuary, it's going to be very difficult to hunt from beginning of the season to the end of season and having a lot of interactions unless you've got just crazy, crazy good cover. But those properties are very tough to find. Those with poor access, some of the best things that you can do even prior to getting in and doing a lot of habitat work is just improving access, whether it's another entryway in or pushing roads out to the boundary like you talked about. Just improving that can really increase the effectiveness of hunting. Then when you do the habitat management side of things, it really, really pulls it all together and makes a property hunt way bigger.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, fantastic, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast here and chatting about harvesting a Michigan giant. I mean, that truly is a fantastic deer. You were sending me photo updates and kind of some hunt updates throughout this past season, and obviously extremely happy that you're able to put a tag on him and get him down. But I mean, that it's hope for anybody to be able to get out there, do the same thing, devote time and energy into one, learning and then implementing what you've learned on a property and having it pay off. That's huge. A lot of, you know, I would say misconceptions there about the potential of whitetail hunting, potential of deer in Michigan. But man, I'm very hopeful that next few years things are gonna change and continue to develop age structure wise there in the state. And I don't think that this is gonna be your only big deer encounter or opportunity. I think you guys are doing as a co-op in your general region a lot of really good things, and a lot of it just comes down to education. And I think you guys as a co-op are certainly devoted to that, and I tip my hat to you guys for that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's been fun and like you said, rewarding. Just a long road ahead.
That's it.
It does get discouraging. It really does.
I'm sure it can. And
everybody's got to keep their heads up around here. And
yeah.
No, we don't need to shoot 2 bucks every year.
Nope.
I'm okay with, you know, not shooting a buck every year. I can go a few years without it.
Sure. Especially when you know that there's the potential out there to grow these things.
We've got so many doe. We shoot a lot of doe off this property.
You're right. Yep.
So. Yep.
A lot of meat to go around.
Yes.
Well, Jason, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story, your insight, and I hope next year is going to be just as good for you guys and your kids. I know you've got some boys who probably have some itchy trigger fingers, and they're only going to get even more itchy in the next few years. So they're certainly getting into the prime time age for killing some deer.
Oh yeah, that's all they talk about. And we watch hunting shows, and Jackson shot his first buck this year and shot a few doe.
That's awesome.
That's all they want to do, man.
Oh, love it, love it, love it. Well, good stuff, man. Well, you guys have a great Happy New Year, and we will chat with you later.
Sounds good. Thank you much.
Well, there you have it, guys. What a fantastic interview there with Jason out of West Central Michigan. A lot of really important things to kind of draw back to that he mentioned there on the podcast. And I think the first portion is definitely the aspect of what was thought of as cover, the potential of that farm at the time of purchase, and then coming back and realizing I need to make it better. And not only just make it better in a couple areas, but really address the whole farm, bringing in the forestry crew, readdressing basically old clear cuts, burning them, resetting them. Every time or every year that something's not done, let's say to the habitat or has a plan or is working, most likely and in most cases is going to degrade, let's say, the overall habitat. And so a lot of the practices that he was doing were spot on and fantastic. We're glad to be a part of that overall property and the development of it. Invasive species removal is another big thing, guys. You know, we talk about it a lot. It's not the fun or the cool things to do. It's backbreaking. It's exhausting. It's time consuming. But how important is that to the overall development of the property? He just mentioned briefly there, going back in and reseeding in grasses and forbs, and just the reaction, the usage of those acres has drastically changed on that property. And so he's a living proof, living example, a work in progress, let's say, of all the things that we're talking about. And then on top of that goes and kills a very, very, it doesn't matter where you're at, that deer would be a prized animal to be able to take. But that's just goes to show, okay, actively managing, putting in cover, managing natives, improving the property, hunting smart, even in pressured areas, you can get it done. There is a plan. You have to be, definitive on what you're doing. You have to be decisive, and you have to be able to get out there and roll up the sleeves, get after it. And no doubt that he's doing that and living proof. So we appreciate his time. And guys, we appreciate your time for coming and listening to the podcast this week. Guys, it is super refreshing to know that tons of people out there passionate, just like Adam and myself, of just wanting to make the land better. And tip my hat to you guys and girls out there wanting to do it and just taking as much information as you can. So thanks for coming this week to the podcast, listening. Please share with anybody that you may know that needs help. Doesn't matter if you're in Michigan or Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Indiana. Does not matter where you're at. We go all over, and we'll be happy to help you on your property as well. You can find us on Facebook or Instagram, YouTube, or find us at our website, www.landlegacy.tv. Got a consultation tab. If you're interested, click on that. Send us an email through the website, and we will be back in touch with you. Guys, thanks again so much for listening. We'll see you next week. Yep.